Welcome back to the Evolving Enterprises podcast. We have stories of growth and transformation. I've just returned having spent some time with my family at Easter. And the question on my mind at the moment is, how do we get public services back on track? And following on from that, why do we so often blame the wrong people for system-wide failings? In almost every consultancy assignment I've worked on, people are usually trying to blame the wrong people for the situation, at least at the beginning. Let's look at why this is, and let's try and get some answers to how we can get our public services back on track. In thinking about how to improve government services, one thing that I see coming up again and again is there is a terrible and massively counterproductive issue. When public services fail, people become unhappy. And this leads to people taking out their frustrations on the already few staff who are likely to be overworked. They then get frustrated themselves and they become less attentive, and then that compounds the problem, and it just is a vicious cycle that you can't get out of. There are lots of working people who know what it's like to experience public outrage. I can remember as a teenager seeing a small amount of this when I was buying some items in a supermarket. Ahead of me was an old lady who got to the checkout and spent the entire time that she was putting her shopping through complaining to the lady who was working on the checkout about the price of all the goods. And I can remember standing there thinking, what a total waste of breath. It's not as if the lady at the checkout could do a single thing about the price of any one of those items. All that was achieved was a negative atmosphere, and actually nothing moved forward, except for perhaps the old lady felt maybe marginally better, having vented her frustration. But why do we blame the wrong people in the first place? Let's take a look at some of the UK's less loved professions. In the UK, estate agents are not liked very much. Estate agents, also known as realtors in Europe, or real estate agents in America, are the public face of the supply and demand problem that we face. In the UK, that problem is particularly significant. The job of an estate agent is simple. They work on behalf of a seller and they provide marketing and market placement advice for a property, helping sellers to achieve the best sale price for their property in any possible market situation. So in the UK, we have a real problem with supply and demand, particularly with residential property. The UK is a small island, and most of its population centred around the big towns and cities. In a published article that was only possible because of a blunder following a Freedom of Information request for land registry, it was discovered that something like 5% of the UK was available for purchase, so a tiny fraction of an already small island. Vast amounts of land were owned by large organisations and wealthy individuals, so none of that was available for the rest of us to buy, essentially. So this compounded the problem of finding space to live for a family in the UK. A much smaller amount of land can actually be built on, of course, and this leads us to a position where there are very few homes that meet the needs of each potential buyer. From the point of view of a purchaser, the UK system can seem quite a challenge. Whether you want a house that's in a wonderful country location or in a city, there's generally a lot of people who also want to live there. Whatever the market conditions, a property in a desirable location will have a lot of people come to it as it comes up for sale. And estate agents are really good at making that demand seem greater than it really is and helping the seller to achieve the best possible price. The seller, of course, still has the option not to sell, demonstrating, as economists would say, elasticity. The seller can decide to rent out their house at the last minute if they want to. And so the purchase process from a buyer's perspective can be really daunting, and it can feel as though you're in a very weak position. And of course, the person who is the face of the seller during this entire process is the estate agent. So why do we dislike the agent and not the people who've created this situation? In the UK, house builders could build a lot more houses, but the land banks that the house builders sit on are not being utilised, despite many government promises to make them build more houses. Very little ever changes. The simple fact is that it's not in the interests of the large house builders to release very many houses at once. Basic economics will tell us that the price will fall as supply rises. One of the few places in the UK where there is actually oversupply is in one-bedroom flats in city centres. As a property developer, these are the only types of property to avoid if you want to make any money. Everywhere else, the market is really struggling. People are really, really struggling to find what they want in this free market. We have a similar situation in terms of frustration in the UK with other things. And again, the public face of one of these struggles is the traffic warden. Traffic wardens issue fines for parking in the wrong place. And they're, of course, universally disliked by many drivers, especially the people who are parking in the wrong places. But as any traffic warden will tell you, they're only doing their job. If we go back in history, back as far as biblical times, tax collectors were disliked. Even today, quite a number of the people who work for HMRC in the UK or the IRS in America would choose to describe their role as a central government employee rather than mentioning anything to do with tax if they were asked to describe their job when they meet people at a party. But in so many ways, it's foolish for us to have a problem with the implementer of government policy. Traffic wardens will tell you that they're only there to do their job. They're there because a local council tells them to go and do it and pays them for that. And actually, we know in the round that if they weren't there, there would be chaos on our roads. There would be parking in ridiculous places where people would be parked on the tops of hills and round blind corners, and they would be parked so that you couldn't even move across a road sometimes. So traffic wardens actually do quite an essential job for us. Tax is only collected because our government has set tax levels. And we elect our government. So why are we not angry at the government or the council, but we choose to take our frustrations out on the individuals who administer these policies? Like the lady in the supermarket, we have the wrong model in our head. Delving into systems thinking for a moment, Conant and Ashby said that to regulate a system, you need to understand it. We may not be in a position to regulate our country, but we are in a position to make some changes. So if we want to make a system change, we need to understand where we can have leverage, another key systems thinking approach. Leverage is the ability to take a small change and have a big effect from that. In the political balance between the extremes of full-blown capitalism and far-left communism, most of us sit somewhere not at those extremes. Most of us want to sit between those positions. Most of us want to have a nation which has a level of public service. We believe that it's important to protect vulnerable and disadvantaged people. And we believe that we need to educate the next generation of our country. We also believe that healthcare should be available and available to all. The problem then comes when we consider how do we pay for this. Mervyn King, the former governor of the Bank of England, once put this very well. He described the issue as the UK wanting to have European-type public services, as in lots of public services, with a lower tax burden of the USA. So basically his point was, you're not going to get it all. So again, people will blame their doctor for not being available enough. But they don't see this as a problem to do with the way that public sector money is administered. People will complain that there's not enough support for low-income families with children. And yet they blame the people who are administering these systems rather than those who are making the decisions about how it's allocated. This is a really convenient position for the decision makers, because they don't feel that they have to face the recipients of a decision on a daily basis. If they did, no doubt they would think a bit more carefully about what decisions they felt they could defend. In today's world of late capitalism, where a globalised post-industrial economy has turned everything into a commodified and consumable quantity, we're in a position where large systems are used to control what we do as a population. As an example of this, let's consider roadworks. In the past, if a road was closed in a town, then the people in the town might actually have some say in whether it was closed or not. But more importantly, the people who were struggling to make their way around that town would be able to go and talk to the council or the people who were working on the road, and they would get to the decision maker, and there would be an ability to discuss what's being done. Now, it might be that there's a really big bridge that needed to be repaired and it's going to take a year to do it. Well, okay, no one can really speed that up, in that situation, perhaps. But at least they can have the discussion. At least they know, where they are. In the UK, road closures happen all the time. Motorways are closed all the time for various reasons. Sometimes for urgent repairs following an accident. Sometimes for improvement works. But the people who use these systems have no say at all in what will happen. The same goes with new speed limits. Theoretically, there's some consultation about whether a new speed limit will be implemented. But in practice, only one side of the argument is ever heard. The people who live beside the busy road will undoubtedly campaign for a lower speed limit. But the people who actually use the road will have no ability to influence this. We've become entities who have no direct voice. And if we want to follow something up, and I do follow quite a few of these things up, I do issue freedom of information requests, which in the UK allow you to access quite a lot of public sector information. I do try and find out what's going on when our public services don't work. But honestly, it does take forever to find out who's actually made a decision. If you want to know why the road that you are travelling on has been closed, then people will pass it from one place to another. Sometimes it's a central government decision, sometimes it's a local government decision, sometimes the police make a decision. And you have to go and do a bit of ferreting around within each organisation if you want to really find out what's happening. But the simple fact is that travelling in the UK is getting increasingly frustrating. Journeys are taking longer than they did in the past. And the combination of roadworks, incidents, or whatever that means, could be an accident, it could be some other reason why the roads are closed, and also traffic volumes. And that combination of the three things are generally to blame. And this has quite an impact on the lives of everyone, not just the people who use the roads on a regular basis, but the people who are receiving parcels, the people who are running businesses. They're all impacted by the fact that our roads are getting slower. It costs us more and it takes time. More worryingly, at some point, it's quite likely that all of us across the UK and wherever we are in the world will need an ambulance. And as the traffic situation gets worse, it becomes ever more difficult for an ambulance to get to anyone who's sick in an appropriate time. So I think it's important to convey our feeling of frustration appropriately. I think that bottling up that frustration is only going to make things worse. It's only going to make the people who are struggling feel worse and feel less valued. I'm increasingly convinced that the reason, the primary reason actually, why many large organisations have a complaints procedure is not to improve anything at all, but actually to channel people's anger and outrage at a complaints process rather than at the checkout assistant or the traffic warden. In complaining appropriately, I think we also have to take into account some cultural differences. I have an Italian friend who was used to complaining in Italy when things didn't go his way, in quite a flamboyant and dramatic manner, which seemed to work well enough for him in Italy. But when he arrived in the UK and had a bit of a problem with a ticket clerk, The ticket clerk simply put the desk closed sign up, pulled down a blind and retreated. So what works in one society won't work in another. Society only allows you to complain in a certain way. And there are limits, of course there are, to what we can do. Each society has its own tolerance level for what it deems to be appropriate. Unlike some of our European neighbours, on the surface, the UK seems to have a relatively high tolerance level for frustrations. I can recall very well the financial crisis of 2008, and an American commentator looking at all of these queues that had formed around sort of all of these fragile financial institutions, queues of people trying to get their money out before the place went bust. And I remember an American chap looking at this queue and saying, well, my goodness, you know, you Brits, you are very orderly in the way that you queue. You know, in some nations, people would be pushing past one another and, you know, complaining and all sorts of things. But we stood there, you know, in line and waited for potentially hours on end in order to be able to access our money. And so we seem to tolerate frustration. But actually, the signs of intolerance are everywhere, literally. In almost every shop you walk into, whether it be a local newsagent or a big supermarket in the UK, you'll find a sign fairly much in your face as you go to pay for anything, saying, we will not tolerate abuse to our staff. Some of them say, we'll call the police if you threaten us. And even in small towns, the schools have to have signs in their visitor area and the reception saying that they won't tolerate, you know, people being rude to staff. I've often wondered whether this rise in rude or abusive behaviour is because people feel more repressed or because they feel more entitled. In the 2019 NHS staff survey, and this was before the pandemic had hit, of course, 15% of NHS staff say that they had experienced physical violence from members of the public and patients in the past year. And that figure rose to a staggering 34% of ambulance trust staff. These are not the enforcers of the law. They're not the faceless decision makers that are causing suffering to people, but the people who were there to keep us well and safe. How much worse must this be for an inner city traffic warden? There is evidence that the world is getting more stressed all around. According to a study from Penn State University comparing stress levels from adults in 1995 and 2012, it was the people who were 50 to 64 who were the most stressed. Potentially the reasons for this are raising young adult children, getting them started in adulthood, at the same time as taking care of older generations. And I think we've all been in a situation where we're being pulled from one place to another. We have pressures on us at work, we have pressures on us from our family. So if we're more stressed, should we bottle this up or should we let out our feelings? I think it's important to let out, you know, the way we feel, at least make sure that people know, you know, how bad things are. We've already shown that our unhappiness can be expressed in a number of ways. And making this felt to the wrong people is pointless. But what about making the decision makers feel a bit of the weight of public opinion? Making them feel a bit of the weight of the decisions that they're making? In the UK, any kind of full-scale rebellion is relatively rare. One of the most famous rebellions was the poll tax riots of 1990. On the face of it, in the rational dimension, the change that was proposed was actually fair to quite a lot of people. So the policy was to move from a local tax that was set by the size of a house to a per person tax. So a large family of adults living in a small house would pay far more than a couple living in a manor house. The logic was sound. We use our local services on a per person basis. The levy pays for the police, it pays for local and councils, the traffic wardens, all those things. And so the phrase that was used at the time was that the dustman and the duke will pay the same amount. This was very bad politics. The riots led to the scrapping of the tax, eventually. And more recently, of course, there has been political unrest in the UK due to the Brexit vote in 2016. Scotland has seen its own issues in terms of whether it should be an independent nation or not. Both the Brexit vote and Scottish independence are really, really tough political issues because the UK is basically split 50-50 on whether it's a good idea, or at least Scotland is split 50-50 on whether it wants to be independent, and the UK as a whole is split 50-50 on whether it wants to exit the European Union or not. And so politicians are terrified of those things because they know full well that they're going to upset, well, around about 50%, potentially even more, of their voters. When we look at our European neighbours, France has always been seen as a country of people that will make their feelings known, much more than the British people. There have been the pension protests in 2023 over the French government's aim to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64. There was the recent siege of Paris that took place as the French farmers blockaded major roads in protest at falling incomes and rising bureaucracy and competition from imports. The farmers aim to make their point by stopping deliveries to the supermarkets. So that's a way of showing, you know, power and showing what, you know, you can do. In our quest to make public services better and to help millions of people who are struggling with life in a Western economy, what does all this tell us? Let's go back to the currency of the system's journey, the emotion, the politics and the rationality. The rationality is simple, in that the UK and in many countries there's a lot more competition for resources, whether those resources be access to houses, access to the best universities, or even access to a parking space. Access has got a lot easier for the people at the top, and they have the resources and the connections to navigate the complex system and make it work in their favour. So is it then a failing of capitalism? Well, not really. Capitalism has always been very good at one thing, balancing supply and demand. Capitalism naturally means that money is held by the people who control the system. But pushing against this is the fabric of society and the rules that protect social fabric. Formal rules like the taxation system exist, while the informal rules are the expectations that society has about how we go about our daily lives, how we coexist with others. Drawing all this together and thinking about how we might get to a solution, I'll look at this from two perspectives. Making improvements from a government perspective has to include more kindness and support. There's all sorts of rational arguments why it's good to close, I don't know, 25 miles of motorway over a period of time. But actually, that exhibits no kindness whatsoever. There needs to be a genuine sense of helping people, helping them to feel valued, just as you would treat maybe a member of parliament visiting a new building. The MP wouldn't be told, wait outside for an hour in the rain. We need to stop treating ordinary people like muck. And I really do mean like muck, and I could use an awful lot of other words here, because frankly, that is how people are treated by us as society. And there are more and more people being treated this way. It wasn't something that was done in the past. People in small towns and villages were respected. They were respected by their neighbours. We're not pawns on a chess set. We all deserve to be treated with dignity, the same way as a visiting dignitary would be treated. So when you call a government helpline and you have that annoying music play for an hour, interspersed with, when you speak to somebody, please be kind to them, people will probably not be best pleased when they do get to speak to somebody. It takes sometimes months to deal with a simple request from a government system, and people get angry in that time. So it's really important that people are treated with kindness. And the government has a really massive approach to making this better. From a personal perspective, it's essential to make sure that we direct our complaints at the right person. Unlike the lady complaining to the supermarket checkout assistant for the supermarket prices, it's time to go back to our understanding of the system. And for that, we have to stay informed about the real system. And sadly, these days, reading the conventional media, we can develop quite a bias. It's important to stay informed about what's really going on. And we can be informed through organisations that are highlighting what's really happening. In the UK, the Byline Times is one of the independent newspapers that's willing to talk about what the papers don't. And from that, we can form a view of what is really genuinely happening. Information and leverage will be the key to helping people to transform and move our society forwards. And in the end, what people want is to experience more kindness and joy in their work and in their lives. That isn't much to ask for. We really need to be better at doing this. Working together, we can achieve it. This is the Evolving Enterprises podcast. Thank you for listening.